Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Copper Bullets, the four-part series from Amazing Sports Stories, is available now.
Zambia was considered as an underdog.
Are we going to do the impossible here?
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are taking note of the fact that the face of protest may be changing in Kenya as young demonstrators take on a new government tax bill their way.
It's different. The face of the protesters has changed, Audrey. It's not the politicians. It's not the older young people involved in this. These are Gen Zs.
Burundi's government blames the high cost of living and critical shortages on sanctions that were lifted 2 years ago already. The opposition lays the blame elsewhere. But how did Burundi get here?
Burundi came to this point because of some bad policies in general. Some will pretend that this is caused by the sanctions that were taken against Burundi government in 2015, but this is not true.
Also, South Africa is piloting a plan to train traditional healers to test their clients for HIV to try and overcome stigma. It's Friday, the 21st of June. We're going to start with the protests that have rocked Kenya this week and caught the attention of people across the continent. This is the sound of hundreds of young people dressed in black singing the Kenyan national anthem in Nairobi. Kenya is no stranger to street protests. Pro-democracy demonstrations were huge in the 1990s, and since then, political parties have brought massive crowds to the streets. But observers are saying that these protests are different. They may not be as big as some of those in the past. Protesters' numbers in the thousands rather than the tens of thousands. But their organization is grassroots and social media based. What's more important, they appear to be sidestepping the ethnic arithmetic that is the default setting for Kenyan politics. And although they have not been met with the same police heavy-handedness of the past, one person was shot and killed. And the Kenyan Red Cross is reporting that at least 39 people were injured, 9 of them critically. Let's take a closer look at these protests and the protesters. And who better to point out the nuances than Richard Kagoe in Nairobi?
Hi, Audrey.
Richard, we haven't spoken in a while, and you haven't been on Focus on Africa, the podcast, while.
Yeah. It's been a lifetime, Audrey. It's been a couple of weeks, but I'll be back very soon, just out on assignment for now.
And here you are, doing the thing, telling us, Focus on Africa podcasters, about Kenya, specifically in this case, because we've been seeing in the news all week young Kenyans out on the streets protesting. We've seen Kenyans out on the streets before protesting, but everybody's saying that this is different. What's different?
It's different because the face of the protesters has changed, Audrey. It's not the politicians. It's not the older young people involved in this. These are Gen Zs. So we're looking at people who were born in the late 90s and early 2000s who are taking part actually in these protests. Even when you look at how the whole mobilization and coordination of the protest is being done, Audrey, it's being done on social media. It's on TikTok. It's on X. It's on Instagram. And the young protesters, what they're doing is they're not carrying stones. They're just using their smartphones. They're streaming the demonstrations. And you get a sense like the young people are enjoying what they're doing, and there's a certain zeal, there's a certain energy that's totally different. Audrey, this is just unprecedented.
Okay, I'm going to stick my head out here and say that the protests of the 90s had the similar energy. There were young people out on the streets. There were people saying, we want a better Kenya, and they were young. What I'm wondering is, who organized these protests? Because back then, and of course we've seen those protests through the last 20, 30 years, those protests were organized by opposition political parties. I'm wondering whether in this case that is happening as well, or is it entirely from within the generation and not motivated by party political interests in Kenya?
So this is from within, because I can tell you no politician is involved in this. And the young protesters have made it very clear they don't want any association with any politician or political party. So the organization has been somewhat organic. And how it started out was young people just having discussions on TikTok and expressing their frustration, their concerns about the controversial finance bill and its proposed taxes. Because what they're saying is, this is really going to affect them. It's going to affect their future. So what they're saying is, the older generation, you step aside, we want to secure our future. What they're saying is their parents, their older siblings, they have failed them.
And do you think that this shows a new direction in Kenyan protest politics? Because in the past, politicians were able to mobilize people on the basis of Kenya's tribal and ethnic arithmetic. But is this different in that sense as well?
It's different because, Audrey, when you speak to young people, they tell you is they really don't quite care about your class, your political persuasion, or any links or what you prefer. Ethnicity, they just don't care. What they're saying is, we are all Kenyans. We are young people. There's so much that's at stake here. These are people who have grown up really, they don't quite have that association like their parents did with where they came from, and largely identify themselves with a tribe or a political leader from a particular region. This is just something that has galvanized all of them. This is just about issues.
I see, very interestingly, lots of comments about this. People talking about, you know, a new fulcrum and a new and different generation of Kenyans. And this one particular commentator says that they found their rather loud voice, which slightly sounds to me a bit like a Gen Xer looking slightly disapprovingly on the style and fashion of this particular form of protest. But I'm just wondering whether people looking at it, older Kenyans, are they excited about this and saying, well, some of us brought the struggle this far, this is the new generation that has got to take it further? Or are there people who are outright disapproving?
Audrey, the reaction is this, and I can tell you from a WhatsApp group that I'm in. So it's just about residents. We're about 4,000 of us. And so we're having the, you know, leaders there. And initially when they had their first round of protest, people thought this was going to be a passing fad. But when they did the second one, people are conflicted. They were like, okay, what is this? Where is it starting? And where is it headed to? And a lot of them really expressed solidarity with the young generation that has really gone out to the streets to protest. What they're saying is they're entitled, it's their right, and they're really shocked by just the fact that they could mobilize, organize themselves. There's a story, one of my colleagues was out in the streets yesterday and met this lady who's 56 years, and she said she's come to express support for her nieces who are 19 and one who's 26, just expressing support, saying that as a generation, she said, they had failed, but she's here to support them.
President Ruto was in the U.S. and he's making interesting moves on the international stage, positioning Kenya in a very particular way in relation to the West. What I'm wondering is there a sense in which he's too busy doing that over there and not looking at the people, the young hustlers, you know, that were his base, and the dissatisfaction that they are feeling with the way in which government at home is conducting itself?
I think there's a sense that people feel that possibly the president could be disconnected with the reality of everyday Kenyans. And the thing is, when he was on the campaign ground during that time, he was sort of like identifying and resonating, especially with young people and the challenges that they face. Because what he said is, I'm going to ensure that there's going to be equality, when it comes to governance, when it comes to matters of the economy, and just leveling the playing ground for everybody. But people are saying you're catching flights, they're traveling to different parts of the world, having these meetings and making these fantastic, glowing, you know, promises. But the young people feel there's nothing to show literally. Here we are, we're being subjected to taxes and just making life quite unbearable. So there's a feeling that possibly the president seems to be disconnected with the challenges that people are facing on a day-to-day basis. And that's why they're saying, you know what, this has been simmering for a while, but we want to make a statement by coming out to the streets and venting out.
Where will they take this to? It's localized, right? People are looking at taxes. The government has reversed some of those taxes. Are they going to continue saying, well, actually, you know, life's not great for us anyway, and it's not just a localized issue?
Despite the fact the government has scrapped a couple of proposed taxes, young people are saying members of parliament shoot down the entire bill entirely. So they're just saying, we want to start this on a clean slate, and we want our voices or issues to be factored in as you're making all these governance decisions. Some of them would be telling you, if life becomes a bit unbearable here in Kenya, I'll just migrate to another country where there's a certainty in terms of job prospects and economic opportunities. So that's what a lot of young people are saying. But they're saying this, we're not going to give up. We're going to push this, and they're very hopeful that something is going to make way as a result of the protests that they've been doing.
That was Richard Kagoe in Nairobi. There are, of course, people for and against. We received a couple of WhatsApp messages from either point of view.
My name is Nyawanga Iniluv Owor, and I am a 20-year-old law student and somewhat of a youth activist, and I am one of the many, many Gen Zs that has been out on the streets of Nairobi in the last couple of days. I personally am opposed to the finance bill for several reasons. I like to think I wear many hats, meaning I'm a feminist, I'm a young woman, I'm a law student, and I'm the average Kenyan trying to pursue a dream. And my problem with this finance bill is many of the clauses included are actively working against us as young people. In regards to how far we are willing to go, I personally would be willing to protest again. Yesterday at the protest, we lost a young life, we lost Rex. Rex's death cannot be in vain. At the end of the day, our idea is for our government to wake up and know that our Gen Z voices must be heard. And come 2027, I think we have collectively decided as Gen Zs that we must hit the ballot. We will not make the mistake of being inactive in politics ever again.
My name is Susan Mwende Muthoni. I'm a youth and I am supporting the Finance Bill 2024. It's a hotly debated Finance Bill 2024, and I am happy as a young person that the youth of Kenya are awake today. They can hear their concerns, they can raise their views and their ideas. I'm also happy the government is listening to the voices of the young people. The bill, although it's appearing punitive on the face, it is quite an interesting development from the way the government looks at tax, and as well as the way Kenyans feel about taxes and levies. For a start, the government feels it is trying to be innovative in its tax regimes and its attempts to broaden the tax base. I feel we should support this bill, and when time is right, we will ask the government of the day, what did you do with our taxes? Because our country must continue running.
Kenyans for and against the ongoing protests. We're in Burundi now to talk about the biting shortages of fuel, electricity, medicine, and other essentials. The cost of living is high. Power outages happen daily. That sounds like the situation anywhere and everywhere on the continent. But the government is banning people from queuing up to get petrol to conduct their business. Sometimes those people have to wait for weeks for fuel. Burundi is still recovering from economic sanctions by the US and European Union that were imposed in 2015 on grounds of human rights violations. Those sanctions were reversed in 2022. But they led to a loss of donor aid and foreign investment, and at the time, half of the budget came from donor funding. But not everybody in Burundi is convinced that the state of the economy is a ripple effect of the sanctions. I've been hearing from Burundi's veteran opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa. I'm going to start by asking you to tell us what kinds of shortages people in Burundi are experiencing at the moment.
The shortages are numerous. First of all, we have fuel shortages almost for three successive years. We have multiple shortages of electricity, power to each and every day. And these two are very, very serious. But also, water is a problem.
It almost sounds like we're in South Africa, Mr. Rwasa, because we've got water shortages and electricity shortages as well. Not to diminish what is happening in Burundi, but can you tell us why these shortages are happening there?
The shortages are caused mainly by some failures in planning. I mean that, for instance, for water, we have to pump water from Lake Tanganyika while there are some sources above Bujumbura in the heights, which could be captured there and flow directly to citizens in Bujumbura for consumption. But unfortunately, this has been neglected and even today is still neglected. With regard to the shortage of electricity, what I can say is that there are some hydropower dams that were to be built from 2012, which are not yet completed because money has been misused by those who were meant to manage these projects. But very serious is the shortage of fuel.
You've said to us that they've been there for a good few years now. These are not new shortages. But explain to us the knock-on effect that it has on the standard of living of the people of Burundi. For instance, what kinds of things does the fuel shortage bring about? Are people able to get medicine or, you know, the things that they need from neighboring countries to come into Burundi because Burundi is landlocked?
Yeah, Burundi is landlocked, but if it were well managed, all this landlockedness would not cause us any problem. Now, with the shortages of fuel, first of all, it is hard to get from this point to that other point. The transport rate has been multiplying, and while the revenue has not been boosted. So this has been coupled with some kind of inflation, where we observe more than 26% of inflation. It means that everybody now is experiencing some kind of hardship because all the goods are now very, very dear. And the Burundians, for instance, the civil servant who rely on their wages only, are in trouble.
I'm interested in how ordinary Burundians, you know, when they go into a shop, what would they find there and what would be missing because of this economic crisis that you're experiencing?
You can find everything there, but in tiny quantities and very expensive. Even local goods, such as we produce rice, but the cost is high. Beans, the cost is high. Plantain, the cost is high. Everything.
How did Burundi get to this point?
Burundi came to this point because of some bad policies in general. Some will pretend that this is caused by the sanctions that were taken against Burundi government in 2015, but this is not true.
Well, sanctions do have an important impact, don't they, on the economy of a country, especially if you relied on support from countries in the EU and from the US. That is the government's position. They say that that's the reason why Burundi is in the state that it is. You're saying it's not. It's due to corruption and mismanagement.
Yeah, because this issue of sanctions was just an alibi. Because they suspended the support of the budget, the government of the budget, but they could be involved in other areas. For instance, IMF, World Bank, even the European Bank for Investment could grant some loans to Burundi in that period. But there was mismanagement of all of this money because I can tell you, for instance, there was a loan of 72 million euro from the European Bank of Investment for the construction of hydropower, which would be producing electricity from 2021. This money has been misused, and this hydropower is not yet completed. Some couple of months ago, we were to ratify another loan grant of around $15,000. to see if they can complete this hydropower, for instance. So mismanagement is the problem. This issue of sanction is just an alibi to justify what kind of situation we are in now.
But tell me this, did sanctions and cutting of budget support not have any effect on the Burundian economy?
I may say that the effect that it had was only on some people, because this support to the budget in terms of paying salaries and whatsoever, it was directed to a group of Burundians, not all Burundians. If Burundi had some project to be financed, what happened? I just gave you an example where the European Bank of Investment could give a loan to Burundi. If these sanctions were total, not a single penny would have come in Burundi from that time. But this happened in that period.
Let's talk about the petrol queues. It seems that the government is stopping people from queuing up for fuel. Do you know why they're doing that?
No, I think it is just something that they decide to do in order to hide that situation to people from abroad who can come and see those shoes, nothing else. Because it's a shame. It's a shame to see a country where cars will be waiting for fuel for weeks on a petrol station. I think it is just only to try to avoid this image to be seen by strangers.
What do you think should be done to turn the situation around the economy?
What is needed first is to develop a culture of accountability from the institutions and let the democratic system be in place, really, and be implemented, not just to be spoken on the mouth. Because when you can see that everything is likely managed by the Central Committee of the ruling party and not by the institution of the republic, then you understand that this chaos may be there. If the president and his government want to manage the country in the good way, they must assume that they are there for the republic, not for their party.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome.
That's Agathon Rwasa in Burundi, veteran opposition leader. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
Sie führen täglich hitzige Fußballdebatten? Dann probieren Sie jetzt die Big Mac-Methode. Denn nur beim Big Mac sind sich alle einig.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Die Big Mac-Methode schlichtet Diskussionen über Handspiel, Abseits, Videobeweis, Aufstellung, Taktik und Auswechslungen. Bei Ineffektivität wird keine Haftung übernommen.
Alltag in der IT-Zentrale.
PCs mit KI können die User-Produktivität steigern und Cyberangriffe schon im Vorfeld erkennen.
Tada! KI rettet Firmen-PCs.
Jetzt mit Leistungsboostern.
KI für Firmen-PCs mit Intel Core Ultra-Prozessoren und Intel vPro. Ergebnisse können variieren. Mehr auf intel.de/itheroes.
HIV and AIDS have long been mainstays of health and social stories about Africa. But it has fallen out of the news headlines in recent years, overtaken by COVID, cost of living crises, war. But researchers have quietly been working away at the illness and its social consequences. South Africa, which has one of the highest rates of infection in the world, has tried numerous campaigns to get people to test and to get treatment, from community campaigns, television dramas, and nationwide marches, as well as court cases. But still, testing rates aren't satisfactory, and there is still shame attached to being positive or having AIDS. And this is where sangomas, or traditional healers, come in. In a pilot run by the University of the Witwatersrand, traditional healers were trained to test their clients and patients for HIV. This is not the first campaign involving sangomas, so what made this one different? I spoke to Wonderful Mabuza, who's a researcher on the study, to find out.
So we recruited 15 traditional healers. They were trained first to do HIV testing and they were certified. And then we started with the process of testing. So it required some bit of community entry engagements and also engagement with stakeholders. The Department of Health was involved since we needed to work with clinics. We actually tested, I think, around 500 clients. We have realized that there are a lot of people who use the traditional medicine as opposed to allopathic medicine, whereby now they don't go to the clinic, they go to the traditional healers, mainly because there's so much trust to the traditional healers, and also because they stay with them in the neighborhoods, so it's easy for them to access them than when one has to travel a longer distance to access the clinic. In the pilot, we only looked at two facilities, but now we got a grant where now we'll be looking at the entire Bushbuck Ridge. We'll be working with 42 clinics and we'll train around 300 traditional healers to conduct HIV testing.
Traditional healers are skilled in very particular ways of delivering their services. Mm-hmm. But to administer an HIV test, you need to be medically trained, right? Because those are medically trained professionals. So what are the challenges in upskilling, as it were, a traditional healer to be able to do that?
It's standard. As long as you are taught, like to say, if it comes in as a two-line or it comes in as one-line, what is the interpretation?
So the issue is the next step, isn't it? For people to test and then to take the results and go further. So does that involve counseling? Is that the reason why traditional healers are so important here?
Exactly. That's where they played a very key role, because of course, traditional healers can see one client a day or even two or three sometimes, which allows them more time to spend with the client and to provide intensive kind of counseling, which then allows the clients to be able to digest the results and be able to move forward in terms of like starting treatment at the clinic.
How good is the primary healthcare system, especially in the area where you're working in Bushbuck Ridge? It's a rural part of South Africa and the services there are not always very good.
I think there's been some improvement over the years. Even with the study, we've seen that with all the clients that we referred to the clinic where actually they started on treatment. I think also the traditional leaders came in to play a big role, because one part of the gaps was that some individuals will test from a community campaign and will not reach the clinics. However, with the traditional healers' involvement, they were even able to guide patients through that process to take them to the clinic, where now they were able to be seen and started on treatment.
I'm sure you were around when former President Thabo Mbeki caused controversy when he spoke about other factors that made people vulnerable to catching HIV, like poverty, and then also the difficulties in treatment, you know, when they don't have access to food to take their medication. It caused a lot of controversy because people felt that he was muddying the waters and making it more difficult for people to go and get tested and then to get treatment. What I'm wondering is that still an overhang?
It's still an overhang. But over the years, like, we have seen like improvement where now we've seen a huge number of people testing. However, the only challenge that we still faced with was the issue of people or individuals starting on treatment, which I agree a bit with the statement made by the former president in terms of like socioeconomic status maybe as one of the factors that will cause people to not to actually start treatment, because of course you cannot take medication on an empty stomach. And there are also other interventions that in the communities where now agricultural sector has come on board, and that is also improving in terms of the numbers now of individuals starting treatment and staying also on treatment.
So are you then looking at making it nationwide?
It would be upon the Department of Health if they take up and implement across Mpumalanga as a whole or across South Africa. Hence, we are, after the study is completed, then we'll do a presentation to actually guide the process if the Department of Health wants to take over.
I've also been speaking to Shadrach Mashabane, a traditional healer that took part in the pilot study run by wonderful Mabuza. We spoke via his translator, Praises Mnisi. But I'm going to start by asking Mr. Mashabane, how has HIV and AIDS affected the people in your community?
A lot of people have HIV in his community. They are not stigmatized. They take HIV like any other diseases.
Right. Is that because of work that is being done, like we were speaking to wonderful Mabuza about? Because in other parts of South Africa and other parts of the world as well, people are still very much afraid to let their neighbors know that they have HIV.
Some people here in Bushbuckridge Ridge are afraid to disclose because they feel like it won't be accepted by other people in the community.
And are there beliefs that people have that stop them from getting tested?
Yeah, there are people with such beliefs. Some people believe that HIV could be as a result of witchcraft. So they don't believe that HIV is a real thing. They always believe that they've been bewitched.
And when they believe that they've been bewitched, do they come to you, Mr. Mashabane, to lift the curse, as it were? And if they do that, what do you tell them?
He advises them to go to the clinic to seek assistance there before he does anything else to them.
Tell us about this trial that you were part of. How did you find it, you know, doing the medical testing, going through the training to do that, and then the counseling? How was it?
So he enjoyed the training. He learned a lot from the training. He also acknowledges that after the training, he understood HIV more, and it was easier for him to agree to test for HIV, because before they wouldn't do that. They would just treat them traditionally. But now they start with HIV testing, and then if there's anything, they refer them to the clinics for further assistance.
And how many people, Mr. Mashabane, have you referred so far?
So in a period of 12 months, he only referred 4 people to the clinic.
Right. So those are 4 people that have tested and
positive.
How many people have actually tested and tested negative?
Around 30. He's not sure. Between 30 and 40.
Now, how many people do you see in a day, let's say?
Some days he sees only one client, some days 2, some days 4. It depends, honestly, on the people, because they are the ones that come to him. Maybe they heard about him from a client he's had before or from the community.
And so the people who come, many of them come because they've heard of him doing this testing, so they come specifically for that, do they?
Okay. Yes, they used to come when they were still doing the testing, when the study was still ongoing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Praises, thank you so much. Mr. Mashabane, thank you very much also for your participation. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Audrey.
Shadrach Mashabane, traditional healer, and Praises Mnisi, who did the translation. Focus on Africa came together through the efforts of Susan Gashui and Charles Kitonga in Nairobi. Rob Wilson and Yasha Michelle did their bit from here in London. Carney Sharp was our senior journalist on shift. Jack Graysmark, new father to 4-month-old Cameron, was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening. Till we talk again.